Well, you all know what's been going on in Jerusalem and the Middle East. You've been watching the news lately, and I'm sure that the news media, all the major channels and CNN have been just loaded with it. I've been watching it continually. A frail 79-year-old pontiff who is having to walk and lean on a cane, whose hand is going like this with a little sign of Parkinson's disease, is making an historic, first-time ever visit. The world's most traveled pope, one of the longest reigning popes, one who has called continually for Jerusalem to become an international city. When he was in Jerusalem and when he was visiting with the likes of Yasser Arafat on the one hand and Ehud Barak on the other, Yasser Arafat, in a statement that he made, which was off the cuff and was not a part of the prepared speech, welcomed the Pope to the capital city of the new Palestinian state, which doesn't exist as yet. The Pope, I think even the Parkinson's disease didn't cause any movement at that moment, because there was absolutely no visible response from the Pope whatsoever. Then when Ehud Barak welcomed the Pope, he welcomed the Pope to the eternal capital of Israel, Jerusalem. But the Pope, in his remarks, made it clear that he believed Jerusalem ought to be an international city. Now, he's called for what is called a corpus separatum, as you know, for a long time. I think most of you are very well aware of some of the prophecies involving the great false church and the great false prophet. I want you to turn to the 47th chapter of the book of Isaiah. Here is a prophecy about a church, because the Bible uses the symbol of a woman for a church. Israel is referred to as Zion, but is also in metaphor referring to the church in many of the prophecies in the Old Testament of the Bible. And a great fallen woman is depicted in the 17th and 18th chapters of Revelation. We'll come to that in due time. That is also being depicted here. It is called the Virgin Daughter of Babylon. Sit on the ground. There is no throne, O daughter of the Chaldeans, for you shall no more be called tender and delicate. Take the millstones and grind meal, uncover your locks, make bare the leg, uncover the thigh, pass over the rivers, your nakedness shall be uncovered, yea, your shame shall be seen. I will take vengeance, and I will not meet thee as a man. So all of a sudden, no more virgin. Now all of a sudden, she has fallen from that position to become an harlot. As for our Redeemer, the Eternal of Hosts is his name, the Holy One of Israel. Sit thou silent and get thee into darkness, O daughter of the Chaldeans, that is the Babylonian plain called Chaldea, for you shall no more be called the Lady of the Kingdoms. Kingdoms, governments, plural. I was wroth with my people. I have polluted mine inheritance. There are many, many prophecies about that, so many of them that you couldn't recount them all, of Israel going into captivity and of being brutally abused and mistreated and murdered by both a combination of a great single government that has concourse with this great fallen woman, the government called a coalition of 10 states called the Beast, and the great false prophet with a great universal church. I have polluted mine inheritance and given them into your hand. You did show them no mercy. Upon the ancient have you very heavily laid your yoke. All of you have heard about the apology that the Pope issued, have you not? I've read the entire thing. It's on the internet. It has been lambasted by a lot of people, including the Jewish government in Israel, as being nowhere near thorough enough, because in mentioning only in passing the inhumanity of man during the Holocaust, the Pope did not take responsibility for the silence of Pope Pius XII during the Holocaust, nor the fact that tens, if not hundreds of thousands of Italian Jews were deported from Italy right under his nose, and with, as I have read in books, the complicity, the direct aid of the Roman Catholic Church during the World War II years. Few know that Pope Pius XII was actually in Germany for about 9 years of his life prior to becoming a pope, and how very well acquainted he was with all of the German officialdom, and what an admirer he was of Adolf Hitler. Because the idea was that Adolf Hitler was like a savior of Germany to stand up against Bolshevism and communism. They paraded themselves as the Christian hope for all of Europe and all of the world, and of course did all of their dirty work behind the scenes where even the local people at Auschwitz or Belsen or Majdanek or some of the other places, Birkenau, claimed they didn't even know what that smoke was coming out of the chimney. Upon the ancient, meaning Israel, have you very heavily laid your yoke. And a yoke is like a symbol of slavery. And you said, I will be a lady forever. It reminds me of a woman in American politics. We're supposed to endure another 8 years of those people if she makes it. Anyway, can't help but say some things in passing. And you said, I shall be a lady forever. So that you did not lay these things to your heart, neither did remember the latter end of it. Now therefore hear this, you that are given to pleasures, that dwellest carelessly, that say in your heart, I am. Interesting. Why, that's a title of God, isn't it? That's the very name of God, by which God, the God that we know of as J-H-V-H or Y-H-V-H, Jehovah, as some pronounce it, we don't know how to pronounce it, whether it's Yahweh or Jehovah or Yahweh, but he said, I am that I am to Moses at the burning bush. And he said in the 8th chapter of the book of John to the Pharisees, before Abraham was, I am. The blasphemy of any human being to take the very name and the title of God is such an effrontery to God that it's one of the worst blasphemies of any kind. And of course, that is exactly what it says in the book of Revelation that we'll come to in the 17th chapter. Full of blasphemies, and when you call a man holy, there is no man who is holy. Christ only and God the Father are holy and good and just and perfect. And then you take a title, the Vicar of Christ, and you take the title Father, as if you are an holy Father. It is absolute blasphemy to God. I am and none else beside me. Now, this is what many churches have said. There are some Protestant churches that have said that. As a matter of practical fact, back in the 1950s and early 60s, my father in the Worldwide Church of God said that. We are the only true church, and all others are of Satan, the devil. Well, as the years went on, guess what? We discovered that there was a group down in Chile that had discovered the Feast of Tabernacles and the Passover and had in their Spanish Bibles determined that they should be keeping the Passover on the 14th of Nisan and the Feast of Tabernacles on the 15th of the 7th month. They knew about the weekly Sabbath. They were observing the laws of God, and they had come to it utterly independently, never having heard of the Worldwide Church of God or any of its predecessors. We found that the same thing was true among a small group in Italy. And we found other people around the world, as I've said, the proverbial desert island with the Bible that washes ashore in a trunk. If somebody simply looked at it, began to read it, they would discover the same things that my father did. And if they didn't have someone there to twist it and pervert it and tell them it didn't mean what it said, what they were reading, they would come to the same conclusions we had in the 1950s and 60s. But that was a very unfortunate statement. Shouldn't have been made. We never, of course, claimed those kinds of titles, but this exclusivism and claiming that you're the only one is just like fighting words to other people. It is putting them down. It's saying you are of the devil. And unfortunately, it is a kind of a spiritual superciliousness and hauteur, which is saying, I am holier than thou. You are not worth the time of the day. You're in the devil's arms. I'm in the Lord's arms. I'm of God. You're of Satan. And it just draws a huge line. That's exactly what Iranians do to the United States. We're called the great Satan, and they worship Allah. Inshallah. Allahu Akbar. You know, how do you put up with that? The midnight haranguer, not just at midnight, he's five times a day out of the minaret. The Pope is sitting there in this square in Bethlehem, and the haranguer comes on. They forgot to shut off the loudspeaker. They are not going to do that, even for the mucho popo who was there. And so there they are, sitting there, sweltering in the sun, the minaret, and the loudspeakers are blaring out, you know, you heard, it just drives you nuts when you're over there. At night it comes on, in the early morning, five times a day it comes on, just blaring like an air raid alarm, jump up. What is that? It's the haranguer. He's calling people to prayer. And it's the call to prayer of the Muslims. And so the Pope just sat there like that, like he was half deaf, and probably wished he were, and didn't even listen to it. I am, they boast, and none else beside me. I shall not sit as a widow. Oh, what does that mean? That means that there's a marriage involved here. So you got a lady of the kingdoms who says, I'm not going to lose my husband. I'm not going to know widowhood. Neither shall I know, the loss of children. So the old whore has kids and a husband of sorts. And she is called Babylon, as we will see, Mystery Babylon, the mother of harlots and the abominations of the earth. Oh, the mother of harlots. Boy, those are strong words. An old waddling madam that is probably so made up that every time she smiles, flakes and chips of this stuff fall to the floor. And just is a real old professional. And this is exactly the picture that the Bible gives us of this church. But these two things shall come to thee in a moment, in one day, the loss of children and widowhood. So all of the children, the daughters that came out of her, and the husband or the consort with which she is at that time in league, will somehow be lost to her. They shall come upon thee in their perfection for the multitude of your sorceries and for the great abundance of your enchantments. It is truly enchanting, I suppose, to enter into a dusty old cathedral that reminds you of a mausoleum where you can hear your footsteps echoing. And I've done it all over the world. I've been to the great, basilicas, St. Peter's, of course, being the greatest of all of them, but in many others like Il Duomo in Milano. And there are all of the sarcophagi. And some of them have glass tops. And in the glass tops, some of them even have little slots. And sometimes here either is the effigy in stone, or in some cases you're allowed to even view a little bit of the bone of the saint that is supposed to be there. And isn't it interesting that people will come by and actually tuck bills, lira, whatever, in the coffins. They use the coffins as a collection box in some of those old places. In the meantime, you are walking on the gravestones of hundreds of people. This is true even in Britain and the Anglican or the Episcopalian church. The Episcopal Church is the Church of England in the United States. That's correct. So right where the Queen is crowned, there are some of the most famous people in all of Britain buried beneath the stones and in the walls and so on. So even the interior of many of these old churches and basilicas are like a graveyard. And they have that kind of an atmosphere. Everybody talks in hushed tones. When somebody stands up to preach, they don't do as I am doing now and just talk. But it's in Latin or very formal tones, and you hear the echoes all around. And it's a very depressing environment, I might add, when you go into some of those places. When you go into such a place, if there is a basilica, like down in Mexico City, where there's a huge big painting, like a raised icon with actual gold gilt on it for the Virgen de Guadalupe, and you see the altars and you see the candelabra and just glittering gold. One time, Ben Ray and I went to a very large one in Tegucigalpa, Honduras, which is the capital. Outside were people on both sides of the street. The gutters had raw sewage running down. You could smell it. You had to step over it on boards. There were people all over these ascending stairs, about 20 of them, that went up to this huge big cathedral. They were in abject poverty, flies all over them. There were prostitutes that were actually soliciting your business on the steps, and poverty and squalor and filth right outside. You go in, and here is this old cathedral, and up there on the altar, solid gold. Millions upon millions of dollars worth of gold, statuary, just gleaming white with the Virgin and the little Christ child, supposedly the original Madonna and child you ought to look up in the Two Babylons by Hyslop. It's come down to us from thousands of years. There were virgin mothers and Madonnas and child long hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years before Jesus Christ of Nazareth. But the contrast was just inescapable. And it reminds me, too, of the people who will go to Lourdes to try to be healed, or Our Lady of Fatima. And it's an enchantment, isn't it? You wait and you say, when is this virgin going to cry? And you focus in on the statue. Get ready, folks. It's like Old Faithful. Let's see, what time is it? Okay, Joe, turn down the air conditioning. Whatever. But then the thing begins to sweat, or it begins to cry, or it begins to exude tears or something like that. Enchantments. You know, people are impressed by ceremony, the way that some of the conquistadores managed to, quote, convert, end quote, the savages that they found in both Central and South America and here in the United States was by pomp, splendor, and ceremony, not to mention the musket. They came to this country with their golden or their bronzed helmets and with their firearms, which the natives had never remotely seen or heard of before, that seemed to them to be magic, that it could just blow away and penetrate a chest from a couple hundred yards. And by the pomp and the ceremony, by having a staff with apparently a wounded person, a dying person on it, and like as not a snake wrapped around it, they could at once convince these people that they had great power. Because there were myths among the Aztecs and the Mayans that someday these white gods with beards would come. And they would come like with wings. And that's the way they interpreted the huge sails on the ships that came. And that they would have great power. Well, the power of the gun was a whole lot more than the bow and arrow and the spear. And when they, in their pomp and ceremony, with a cleric among them, and they invariably had one of these on every one of those ships, would come ashore, they would have a great ceremony. And then they would have the symbols combined of Quetzalcoatl, which is the pagan serpent god, the winged flying serpent of the Aztecs, the Mayans, the Incas, the Toltecs, and all of the Central and South American tribes, as well as Mexico. And it is nothing more than a picture of Satan the devil. If you look at the pyramids down out of Mexico City of San Juan Teotihuacan, and look at all the other pyramid structures like in Chichen Itza, they call it Chichen Itza, but it's Chichen Itza in Spanish, on the Yucatan Peninsula, you will see that they are festooned with snakes' heads. And there was a baptismal font that Dr. Benjamin Ray and I saw for the first time in 1954 when I first went down to Mexico City and went to the Mexico City National Museum. It was used by Catholics in baptizing thousands of their converts. And it was made from a snake. The tail was fanned out on the floor, and then the serpent was wound around and then formed the basin, which was then like a bird bath, you know, with holy water in it. So the believers could walk up to it, and they could see this snake with its great big grinning head and its big poisonous fangs, and this funny-looking character in a dress with a weird-looking hat would sprinkle water in their face out of this dirty old basin, and they could say, well, that was great. I got to go up there, and old Quetzalcoatl spit on me, or whatever it is that they thought, and I'm fine. You know, it didn't cause me any harm. And so there they were, all baptized and becoming loyal Catholics. Well, it was never required of Catholics, nor is it now, to understand what the man up there in the pulpit is saying. As a matter of fact, I believe it was Leo who declared papal infallibility, who actually issued a decree that the Bible could not be read in the vernacular. It must be read only in Latin. Well, Latin was the exclusive language of the intelligentsia, of the educated class, of the priestly class. The average person was illiterate. And they spoke various Indian and other kinds of dialects. They didn't speak Latin, didn't even know what in the world the man was saying. He could have been saying any kind of words, and probably a lot of times they did, just to have fun with it. Probably cussed them out, and the guys sit there and grin, you know. Who knows what could have happened. But it was possible. I'm not saying they did that. I can't prove it, but it just occurred to me because God said you're not to curse the deaf. And people have looked in the Bible to see what God says don't do, and then they've done it. And you're as good as deaf if the guy up there is speaking in a foreign tongue. You don't understand a word he's saying anyway. So if you look at all of this, it is fascinating. And there are great enchantments. When you see a bowl, it has kind of a wafting incense coming up from it. A lot of candles burning. And you light a candle and put it over there. And it to you is very important. God's looking down. Oh, I love the smell of wax. And you walk away and you think, God is watching and it's going to burn for several hours now. And you see weeping and bleeding statues and so on. So, for you trusted in your wickedness, verse 10, you have said, none seeth me. Thy wisdom and thy knowledge, it has perverted thee, and you have said in your heart, I am, and none else beside me, repeated twice. Therefore shall evil come upon thee, you shall not know from whence it riseth, and mischief shall fall upon thee, you shall not be able to put it off. Remember that. You won't know where it's coming from. I'm going to show you where it's coming from. It's coming from their most trusted cohorts. It's coming from their allies. It's coming from their military protectors. and desolation shall come upon thee suddenly, which you shall not know. Stand now with your enchantments and with the multitude of your sorceries wherein you have labored from your youth. Mesmerize the pagans. Use magic. You know, the word magi is where we take the name magic. The word magic comes from the magi that were supposed to be priests of Zoroaster. It was always suspected, all the way down even through colonial America, that anyone who dealt in magic, like a David Copperfield, was looked upon as someone who consorted with evil spirits. Go look it up in the encyclopedia, I'm telling you the truth. For hundreds and hundreds of years, magic in all societies, even in Greece and Rome, was associated with the devil and with demonism. It was not just sleight of hand, try to follow where is the pea under the walnut shell. It was actually of the devil. And there were things involving levitation. There were things involving inexplicable things that you would see, witness, or hear, which were not explainable by any trickery, magic mirrors or lighting or, you know, the black wire that the woman is floating on. Oh, no. These were things that were completely demoniacal and where the devil himself was conjuring up things in order to deceive people in these religions. Now, you are wearied in the multitude of your counsels. Isn't that interesting? You are wearied in the multitude of your counsels. There is no more active State Department than that of the Vatican. I mean, there is no more busy organization in the world than all of those in the Vatican with all of their various envoys to every nation on the face of the earth. They are busy, busy, busy all the time. Let now the astrologers, the stargazers, the monthly prognosticators, you can look in the Tyler newspaper, I'm sure, and you will find that there is an astrology section in a Christian nation. Now, we're supposed to have, in the United States, separation of church and state, and that applies rigidly, most rigidly, to Sabbath keepers than anybody else. There is no separation of church and state when it comes to Methodists, Baptists, Lutherans, and Episcopalians, because they've got their blue laws. Now, you can go across the bridge over here, south of where I live, and on tomorrow, the large, big liquor store, the Fat Dog, is going to be closed. And they've just got a little section to the left that is open. And all you can buy in there is all the beer and the wine that you can stagger out under. You can walk out of there with boxes of wine. But you can't buy the hard liquor. Now, that's a wonderful law, isn't it? That's a blue law. That makes a lot of sense. If you wanted to buy hard liquor, you got to buy it on the Sabbath. Friday and Saturday are the days when people shop for their booze for the weekend, especially Friday. You better look out because there's a stream of traffic going back and forth across that bridge. It looks like the Rose Parade's about to start. And they have got a thing over there, the laws that actually state that you cannot buy hard booze and you can't even buy the beer and the wine before noon. They don't want anybody drunk before noon because they want them in church. Now, over in Australia, they had a law where actually from 5 until, I believe, 6:30 or 7, they close all the pubs in the entire nation because those people are known to really belt down the booze, especially beer. And over there, they say one of their pastimes is called the Technicolor yawn. I'm reciting something that I've read about Australia, so I'm just passing that on. You can deal with that. I won't go on to tell you what that means. So they close down the pubs, so it forces people to go home and eat dinner, or the working class that bomb into those bars about 4 o'clock would never make it home. And so they close them down. Mark has been over there in the last few years, and he'll remember that. And then they open them up again where they can come back and drink at night. It's interesting that there is a sort of a selective application of the laws against the separation of church and state. But you'll notice that there are no laws against Satanism, demonism, astrology, all kinds of palm reading, all kinds of crystal ball gazing, all kinds of tarot reading and Ouija boards. Oh, that's fine. There's not a law anywhere against any of that rank paganism in our society. But there are laws that really single out a Sabbath keeper. And there are rules and regulations in our schools and our workplace that single out someone who has children in school when the Feast of Tabernacles begins in October. Just shortly after school gets started, People have got to go through the terrible problem, and sometimes it really causes them a lot of not only humiliation and mistreatment, but just downright handicap for their children whose grades are handicapped and threatened with all kinds of retaliatory action for pulling those kids out of class for 8 or 10 or 11 days, counting travel, at the Feast of Tabernacles in the fall. It's only God's Sabbath keepers who understand what it really is to wrestle against the beast, the image of the beast, the mark of the beast, and all of that. The other people have no idea what it is. You are wearied, verse 13, in the multitude of your counsels. Let now the astrologers, the stargazers, the monthly prognosticators stand up and save thee from these things that shall come upon thee. Well, they won't, and won't be able to, because they're just a lot of windbags that are doing a lot of mythological nonsense anyway. Behold, they shall be as stubble. The fire shall burn them. They shall not deliver themselves from the power of the flame. There shall not be a coal to warm at, nor fire to sit before it. Thus shall they be unto thee, with whom you have labored, even your merchants from your youth. They shall wander every one to his quarter. None shall save thee. Who? The fallen woman called the Lady of Kingdoms, who is the daughter of Babylon. Now turn to the 17th chapter of the book of Revelation. This is absolutely inescapable. And by the way, as I preach from Revelation 17, I am in step with the Baptist, the Methodists, the Church of Christ, the Pentecostal Church, and dozens of others who know exactly what the 17th chapter of the book of Revelation stands for. There's not a one of them that doesn't know this is talking about the Roman Catholic Church. They know that. And their books and commentaries and religious documents and doctrines and so on prove that. There came one of the seven angels which had the seven vials, verse 1 of chapter 17, and talked with me, saying, Come hither, and I will show you the judgment of the great whore that sits upon many waters. Now, waters, when you see a beast rising up out of the sea, always meant many, many nations of different languages and different places, with whom the kings of the earth have committed fornication. So political concourse between a political organization and a church is called fornication. God condemned Israel for doing exactly that, of having concourse with the kings, because remember, God said, I became an husband unto them. And that the old covenant between God and Israel was like a marriage agreement, God being the protector, the provider, and Israel being the dutiful wife who would be loyal and faithful to her husband. And that is covered in very great detail in the Old Testament. And so for Israel to go after other kings and to form alliances with Egypt or Edom or Moab or some of the other countries was like fornication, like a wife who would simply depart a husband. With whom the kings of the earth have committed fornication, and the inhabitants of the earth have been made drunk with the wine of her fornication. It is a heady mixture, the mystery religion of beads, Latin, candles, cathedrals, holy waters, genuflecting, and all the rest of it. It's a heady mixture. Interesting that the word wine comes from the only Greek word that is always translated wine, oinos, O-I-N-O-S. And you'll recognize that, wine, oinos, it sounds very similar. It's vino, V-I-N-O, from the vine, and that's where it comes from originally, in Spanish or Latin. But this is a substance called oinos, which makes one drunk. So the word oinos does not mean grape juice. Oinos does not mean Chevrolet or Cadillac. Oinos does not mean, you know, Reebok tennis shoes, does it? Oinos means wine. And wine is wine. You don't say that there's such a thing as fermented wine, because there is no such thing as unfermented wine. If it's not fermented, it's not wine. So as an aside, here's an absolute proof, biblical proof. Not only are there plenty of others that Christ was called a winebibber, and how Paul told Timothy, drink no longer water, but a little wine for your stomach's sake and your oft infirmities, but the word wine does mean wine, which is fermented grape juice that has now become wine. And there is not a doubt whatsoever in the Word of God. God Almighty makes wine. Man doesn't make it. It had nothing to do with it. A lot of barefoot women used to enjoy jumping into the vat and stomping on it, and that was a very messy way. You saw the one episode with Lucy, I imagine, one of the funniest things I've ever seen, in I Love Lucy, where she and her the other gal jumped in this great big vat, and they're stomping around all the way up to their knees in these grapes. and just having a grand old time. Well, the grape juice came out of the sides of the vat, and then they just let it sit on the leaves, and God takes care of the rest of it. They just squeeze the juice out of the grapes, and God takes care of the rest of it. What comes out depends entirely upon the kind of grape you put in there. And there is a grape that, is called a Merlot, and there are different grapes of different kinds and come from different parts of France or California. So having covered that pretty thoroughly, this wine that is referred to here is doctrine. It's very heady and very wonderful doctrine to grant you indulgences so that you may go, if you wish, to a priest who is sitting in a little booth which has had its origin over the centuries and covered in Hefele's church councils as a result of a lot of very unfortunate contact between the petitioner and the penitent one and the one who is being petitioned, the priest. And sometimes apparently the confessions got a little bit lurid, and sometimes there was some hanky-panky that went on. So over the years, they decided to have little slats put in place so that the human hand and arm cannot reach through and it can have no contact physically. And so you go into the side of the booth, some of them have one on each side. And you've heard the jokes about we'll have daily doubles today and all that. There have been an awful lot of jokes about the confessional booth in the Protestant religion. But, and I'm talking about the Jew that stood in for the Catholic priest. And I won't go on to that because you've all heard it probably. But they go into the confessional and they say, well, I've done this and I've done that, and I've repented of it. Well, you'll have to do 16 Hail Marys and 5 Our Fathers, and you should give an extra donation to the church this week, something like that. And so they get the bead, and they go around the bead, and the Zen Buddhists, I think, have to keep this one finger out. So that's the one they use to do their ears and their nose, and it's called the dirty finger. And when you see them with their bean bag, they've got a bean bag, they got those fingers in there and counting away, counting these beads. Now, what does that do? You know, I mean, is Buddha looking down to say, he better not miss a bead, I'm sure gonna fix him. He better not get his dirty finger in that bag there. Now, that I couldn't tolerate that. He better keep that finger outside. Religion is amazing, isn't it, when you stop to think about the things some people do. They were made drunk with the doctrine. It's a wonderful doctrine for people to believe that there are no consequences for sin, that there's no penalty to be paid. It doesn't affect anybody or anything. All they've got to do is to go to the confessional, and the priest gives them some kind of abstinence. And, of course, the horrible problem that occurred in the Middle Ages was the selling of these favors by the priests, where they actually would extort money from people depending upon the enormity of the sin, the guilt that they were bearing, and so they would demand a certain amount of money. And they were selling these indulgences. The church will indulge you if you this and that. And look it up in Halley's Bible Encyclopedia and some of the history books about indulgences. That was a practice of that church for a long time. So he carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness, and I saw a woman sit upon a scarlet-colored beast. I'm not sure about the garb of the Presbyterians or the Methodists or the Episcopalians. I just don't know about their colors. A lot of them have black and white. The nuns dress in black and white or brown mostly. But the only church that I really am familiar with where the top-ranked people in it are dressed in scarlet has to be the Roman Catholic Church with the College of Cardinals. They're dressed in a bright scarlet color. It makes me wonder why they did that, because even in the second and third centuries, when that church was beginning to form and gradually growing out of the apostatized former members under the influence of men like Simon Magus and those who over those centuries, remember that took place over a period of time that was about half again or twice as long as the history of the United States. It didn't just emerge all of a sudden after Peter, James, and John were dead. It took all the way to the early first quarter of the third century before they fixed the date for Ishtar or Easter and really became the Roman Catholic Church as we know it today. I saw a woman sit upon a scarlet-colored beast, the beast standing for a great political and military organization, full of names of blasphemy. Not just one name, but many of them. Having 7 heads and 10 horns. Now the 10 horns are the 10 successive revivals in the 7th chapter of the book of Daniel, but here the 10 horns are contemporaneous We'll see that in just a moment when you get to verses 12. I'll just read it right now. The ten horns which you saw are ten kings, which have received no kingdom as yet, but receive power as kings 1 hour, a short time, with the beast. These have one mind, shall give their power and strength unto the beast. These shall make war with the Lamb. Now, if you remember what we went over a couple of weeks ago, the toes on the great image, when I was talking about the image of the beast that spoke, are the ten toes representing the eastern and the western half of the great beast power that will be extant at the time of the second coming of Christ. The image that Nebuchadnezzar saw, and the stone that was cut out without hands and destroyed it, smashed it on the feet, the ten toes. So the ten toes of the image in Daniel 2 and the ten horns on the beast here in Revelation 17 are the same. They are those ten governments that are to be destroyed by Christ at His coming. These shall make war with the Lamb. There's your time element. They therefore are extant and holding sway and at the zenith of their power at the time of the second coming of Christ. And the Lamb shall overcome them, for He is Lord of lords and King of kings, and they that are with Him are called and chosen and faithful. They're called, they're specially selected, and once they're selected, they are faithful. They stick with it. They don't quit. They don't give up. Now back to where we were in verse 4. The woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet color and decked with gold and precious stones and pearls. Some of you in this room have actually been to the Basilica, as it's called, of St. Peter's in Rome. And you are looking at wealth like you wouldn't even begin to imagine. The great pillars of Boaz and that altar up there. And I mean, the precious jewels and the gold. It is just splendiferous. Incredible amount of money. And that is true in many of them all around the world. Having a golden cup in her hand. Whatever. Do you ever go to a religious service where somebody comes out wearing a dress with a funny looking hat shaped like the top of a cathedral in maybe Austria and has a golden cup? Have you ever gone to such a church service? I never have, but I've seen it on television. I've seen it in the movies, and I know which church it is. And it's a golden cup in her hand, full of abominations and filthiness of her fornication. So instead of being a religious object, it's just like she's got the toilet in her hand, isn't it? You just can't imagine any more filthy admixture than what is described here. And upon her forehead was a name written, Mystery. Oh, yes, it's always a mystery. God is an hypostasis. He is unknown, three in one. You can't refer to God as a person. And it's a mystery. Everything is a mystery in the Roman Catholic religion. Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots. Now, who are the harlots? Is there a great mother church that ever had daughters? Sure, of course. People don't like to acknowledge that or admit it, but here's what they'll have to deal with the Bible, not with me. The mother of harlots and abominations of the earth. And I saw the woman drunken with the blood of the saints. Now, recently when the Pope apologized, which is really ludicrous in one sense of the word, as if a modern-day Pope could begin to apologize for 900,000 Waldensians who were slaughtered by his predecessors clear back in the Middle Ages. As I said in passing, they may as well ask me to apologize for George Washington and Thomas Jefferson owning slaves. The idea of owning another human being is so repugnant to me, I can't stand it. I would never think of it. But why should I be required to apologize, because I had nothing to do with it, for what predecessors of mine centuries ago might have done? If I were to investigate the Armstrong line, I might find a couple of maybe stagecoach robbers or con men or whatever in there somewhere. I don't know about any of those people, but there might have been. But I can't apologize for them. I can only go to God and apologize for myself. I saw the woman drunken with the blood of the saints and the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. And when I saw her, I wondered with great admiration. Now, you just deal with this in your own mind and heart. Which church was it who put to death all the way from Polycarp, all the way back to James, the brother of John, all the way back to Stephen in the 7th chapter of the book of Acts, was it Islam? Well, if you know your history, you know that Muhammad hadn't even robbed his first caravan yet. He was still 500 years in the future. Islam never even began to become a religion until the 6th century after Jesus Christ. So no, it was not Islam. It wasn't the Turks on the edge of the scimitar raiding all the way to Vienna and, quote, converting, end quote, people by the edge of the sword and ravaging the entire of the Middle Eastern world and going all the way to India, which is what created the modern problem between Bangladesh, Pakistan, and India because of Hinduism and Mohammedanism or Islam that are there fighting all the time over Kashmir or anything else and killing one another. No, that was not the religion that persecuted Christians. Well, which religion was it? Wasn't the Lutherans. They didn't exist until Luther nailed the theses to the door in Wittenberg. Who was it? Wasn't the Protestants. They didn't come along till long after Zwingli and the Protestant Reformation. Well, what was it? People from Ooga Booga land, animists someplace from darkest Congo? No, wasn't them. Well, then, who is it who did all the persecution and shed the blood of thousands of believers in Jesus Christ of Nazareth down through the dark in the Middle Ages? It was the great existing church, and the leader of that present day church has just acknowledged that. He just got through apologizing for it. I don't think he should have. If the Crusades had not occurred, we'd all be speaking Arabic or Turkish, wouldn't we? I think it's a good thing that those Crusades occurred and tried to stem the flow of that religion that was threatening to overwhelm all of Europe and did overwhelm a tremendous part of the Middle East and the Far East. So you can't not come up with any other explanation for these biblical prophecies from the history of the Middle Ages. And remember, it was yet to be fulfilled during those darkened Middle Ages. This was written at the close of the first century, approximately 92 AD. And Jesus Christ had only been assumed into heaven for about 60 years earlier when this was written. And it was centuries yet to develop, really getting going in the 3rd century, but then the 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th, 10th, 12th, 13th, and on through all of those centuries, it was bloody. The Spanish Inquisition, if you want to read a book that'll mean you probably won't want to eat for a couple of days, just wade through Fox's Book of Martyrs. You cannot even understand the inhumanity to man and the process by which some people feel they have converted to a religion and then become utterly intolerant and hateful toward people of a different religion and want to torture them to make them confess your idea of God. It's just unthinkable. I mean, any person that is a true Christian cannot even imagine the thought processes by which someone arrives at that kind of an attitude. I saw the woman drunken with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. And when I saw her, I wondered with great, not admiration in the way that we use the word today, but meaning awe. It was just astonished. And the angel said unto me, wherefore did you marvel? I will tell you the mystery of the woman and of the beast that carries her, which has the 7 heads and the 10 horns. The beast that you saw was and is not. And that's right where we are today, so to speak, in the middle of that verse. You don't see a beast power today. You see the potential for it. You see nations in Europe coalescing together. You see the fact that Germany is the big power in Central Europe once again, as my father and I have said for over 40-some years. And you've seen that there is an EU, United Europe, getting going, but that is not going to be the configuration in which the final 10 will form together. It's going to be out of the disintegration of all of that and following a global economic collapse and the rise of despotism and dictatorship. And shall ascend out of the bottomless pit. That's merely metaphor. It's impossible to have a bottomless pit because that's just, you know, blank space. But it's merely a figure of speech, and it probably should read the abyss. And go into perdition or total destruction at the end. And they that dwell on the earth shall wonder whose names were not written. So these are carnal people, not members of God's church, shall wonder whose names were not written in the book of life from the foundation of the world when they behold the beast that was and is not and yet is. It will be something to wonder at. There was a young man who's a black African, professing Catholic, quote, Christian, end quote, who made a pilgrimage all the way to Jerusalem from Australia. And when he was asked about it, he said, oh, yes, even though it cost him an awful lot of money, and he didn't have very much money, he was going to a Catholic university, I believe, down there, he was willing to sacrifice anything. He said, any sacrifice is worth it to get to be here and to take part in this and to see the Pope. And the people just nearly fall over in ecstasy. The Pope was standing there, I just saw it this morning, leaning on a cane. He put up his hand, he goes like that. That wasn't Parkinson's disease, he's blessing them. You know, what does that do to you if there's a guy up there who goes like that? You know, what does that mean? I'd rather have him salute me or give me the high sign, hey, you know. But anyway, whatever. It's supposed to mean something, and I think that people out in the audience think, oh, that's wonderful, you know, it really means something. I guess some great wave of euphoria, wow, he just went like that. It was Parkinson's, don't worry about it. But anyway, I'm just kidding. All right. Here is the mind that has wisdom. Let's see if we have wisdom in reading this. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sitteth. Now, where is there a city which is called the Eternal City? Jerusalem is not called the Eternal City. And the Manhattan Indians that sold to the Dutch the entire Ireland of the island of Manhattan for only a few dollars, that New York is not it. It may be called Gotham, but it is not the Eternal City. Springfield, Massachusetts, nope. Tyler, Texas, nope. Sydney, Australia, nope. They're all fairly new cities. What city is it that's called the Eternal City? You all know, it's Rome, right? How many hills are there in Rome? Seven. And how many churches are there on top of each one of those hills? Seven. Vantage points. The seven hills of Rome. There are seven kings, five are fallen, and one is, and the other has not yet come. And when he comes, he must continue a short space. And the beast that was and is not, even he is the eighth, and is of the seven, the same kind of government as was true during the days of the Holy Roman Empire in the Middle Ages. And he is the final one because it says he goes into perdition. Now we read this, but we'll read it again in context. And the ten horns which you saw are ten kings which have received no kingdoms yet, but received power as kings a short time, 1 hour, with the beast. We have tried to deduce what that means by the day for a year theory, Numbers 14:34 and Ezekiel 4:6, and we do know that the spies which went into Israel spied out the land 1 day for a year, meaning 40, and they were there 40 days. But if you take 1 hour, meaning a 24th part of a year, then you're only talking about 2 weeks, and it's rather hard for me to think that perhaps the coalescence of these 10 nations together is only going to last for 2 weeks, but then I guess stranger things have happened. I don't want to put that on this and say that the 1 hour means 2 weeks, that they'll only cling together for 2 weeks. All I can say is it is a short time, and it doesn't say 1 year or one time. The word time is used for a year in prophecy, but 1 hour. These have one mind, that is one goal, one purpose, one policy. Shall give their power and strength unto the beast, and the power and strength of a nation is its economy, its military, its raw materials, and so on. These shall make war with the Lamb. I've covered that dozens of times, and I think that the computer age and computer games and sci-fi movies and all of the extraterrestrial phenomena, the idea of ET, that there is life out there, that we may be invaded from Mars. I think that the mind of millions upon millions of people has been prepared so that Satan will actually cause the beast power to aim rockets. And aren't we right now in the midst of research, and you all know it, of anti-missile missiles? Aren't we providing other nations like Israel with batteries of the Patriot system that are supposed to even shoot down incoming scuds? So if they see this great power approaching, this brilliant light, and like giant armies actually coming to the earth, they're going to aim those anti-missile missiles that will actually detonate with a nuclear explosion up into the area of space, clear outside of the envelope of the atmosphere of this earth. It says they're going to fight Christ at his coming. It'd be stupid to aim an AK-47 up into the sky when something is as high as even a 747, because the bullets just go up a little bit and come back down. So it seems to me that that stage has been set. And the Lamb shall overcome them, for he is Lord of lords and King of kings, and they that are with him are called and chosen and faithful. And he saith unto me, the waters which you saw where the whore sitteth are peoples, crowds, multitudes, and nations and tongues, meaning races. A nation is a political organization that can include many races or one. There are no blonde Japanese. And the 10 horns which you saw upon the beast, these shall hate the whore. Now, why do you suppose that would occur? When before, they had been absolutely together. The whore was riding the beast. Now, when you get on a beast, like a horse or something else, and some people have ridden even buffaloes and other creatures, you probably got a halter or even a bit and some spurs. And you guide it and you control it and you make it do your bidding. You are in control when you ride the beast. Remember the old limerick I've given you time and again? There was a young lady from Niger who smiled as she rode on the tiger. They returned from the ride with a lady inside and a smile on the face of the tiger. Well, like the old limerick, the lady in scarlet mounts and rides the beast, which is the 10-nation coalition, and makes it do her bidding with regard to Jerusalem and other nations in a war, which is rapidly escalating into a nuclear World War III. But then when it all collapses, and when the gigantic hordes come from the east, which includes China, which is a vast nuclear power now, then this beast power is going to turn against the whore and hate her, and the next chapter deals with that. These shall hate the whore, verse 16, shall make her desolate and naked, and shall eat her flesh and burn her with fire. For God has put in their hearts to fulfill His will and to agree and give their kingdom unto the beast until the words of God should be fulfilled. And the woman which you saw is that great city which reigns over the kings of the earth. There is no other city that fulfills that description except Rome. There are governments that only survive at the behest and at the pleasure of the Pope in Rome. In times past, when interdiction has been imposed by the Roman Catholic Church against an all-Catholic government, interdiction meaning the national application of excommunication, it would always mean a rising up of riots on the part of the populace who would overthrow the incumbent government to get rid of them if they incurred the displeasure of the Pope. It's happened all the way down through history. So the papacy actually rules over many of the leaders. And of course, as I mentioned before, you remember it was Napoleon, the only person who dared do it, and he was doing that just to exert his power, to walk up there and to snatch the crown out of the hands of the Pope, not even give the Pope time to crown him, and crown himself. It's a famous painting, by the way, in the Louvre. He was the only one that ever dared to do it. But before that, all of the Roman Catholic, Holy Roman Empire, they were all supposed to be converts to the church, these kings. They were crowned by the popes. All the small little principalities and kingdoms all over Europe, the Bulgars and all of these people were crowned by the popes. The 18th chapter, I won't have time to read it all, but notice it says in verse 2, he cried mightily, this angel with a strong voice, saying, Babylon the Great is fallen, is fallen. Why did he repeat it twice? Well, by the time this was written, there wasn't any Babylon. It had long since, 538, 539 B.C., been destroyed by the Persian and Medo-Persian hordes. They'd walk into the gates dry-shod on that night of Belshazzar's feast. And Babylon had been subjugated by the Persian Empire. Babylon has been in ruins from then until now. I understand that Saddam Hussein has tried to go out there and to do a certain amount of cosmetic refurbishing and so on to make it a tourist attraction, but portions of the original wall are in the Berlin Museum in what used to be East Berlin, and I've seen them. Like the Semiramis Gate, which is there, and the glazed beautiful stones with full color are right there, and I've seen them. But there is a portion of those ruins that have been restored. And it's a tourist attraction, although no tourists, I don't think from our part of the world, go to Iraq. The fact that it's repeated twice means that it's going to fall twice. And the city we've been dealing with here, even though spiritually it is called Babylon the Great, is not Babylon, the political entity that it once was in the plain of Shinar. It is Rome, a city of seven hills. It has become the habitation of demons and the hold of every foul spirit and a cage of every unclean and hateful bird. Do you know what this is telling us? It is telling us, believe it or not, that there is going to be like a giant hole in the ground that used to be Rome, that is going to be utterly destroyed, and that during the millennium there's going to be nothing but smoke going up, which will represent the fire of her burning, and that God is going to bind and to cause these demons and these evil birds to be concentrated right there, and it will be a living, continual, 100-year testimony to all the living people during the millennium of what a horrible fate finally befell those people, just like God destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. If you take this literally. Now, if you don't want to take it literally, that's fine. We will find out later on in the beginning of the millennium whether that's true. For all nations have drunk of the wine of the wrath of her fornication, and the kings of the earth have committed fornication with her, and the merchants of the earth are waxed rich through the abundance of her delicacies. Now, it's depicted also as a great merchandise mart. When they see the destruction of it, they stand, verse 10, afar off for the fear of her torment, saying, "Alas, alas, that great city Babylon, that mighty city, for in 1 hour is your judgment come. And the merchants of the earth shall weep and mourn over her, for no man buys their merchandise anymore. The merchandise of gold and silver and precious stones and of pearls and fine linen, purple, silk and scarlet, and all, as it says, sweet woods, all manner of vessels of ivory and manner of vessels of precious wood, of brass, of iron, of marble, cinnamon, odors, ointments, frankincense and wine, oil and fine flour, wheat and beef, sheep, horses and chariots and slaves and the lives." Do you know that the word means bodies of men? Fascinating. Part of their trade was in the bodies of men. Well, I have been to the Yad Vashem, and I've seen examples of what was made out of human hair. I've seen piles of baby shoes that would reach to the ceiling. I've seen mounds and piles of teeth that were pried out of corpses, brutally taken out. Just tons of gold from the tens of thousands and the millions of Jews whose mouths were completely torn apart even after they died, before they were cremated. And I know that what came out of the crematoriums was spread on the fields. So they're going to deal in slaves from which nation? And bodies of men. "And the fruits that your soul lusted after are departed from you, and all things which were dainty and goodly are departed from you, and you shall find them no more at all. And the merchants of these things, which were made rich by her, shall stand afar off for the fear of her torment, weeping and wailing and crying, 'Alas, for that great city was clothed in fine linen and purple and scarlet and decked with gold and precious stones and pearls. For in 1 hour so great riches is come to naught.' And every shipmaster and a company in ships and sailors and as many as trade by sea stood afar off and cried when they saw the smoke of her burning, saying, 'What city is like unto this great city?'" Tokyo burnt in one night. More than 100,000 people died from a firestorm that was created by the bombing of Curtis LeMay's B-29s. And that fire took more lives than the explosion of the atomic bomb in Hiroshima. Hamburg burnt in one night. A firestorm was so great that it literally pulled horses and people off their feet and sucked them into the maelstrom and caused it to rain and lightning and thunder over the city. And this is going to be no different. A city is going to be destroyed, and people afar off are going to be seeing nothing but a gigantic column of smoke and saying, "What city is like unto this great city?" They cast dust on their heads and cried, weeping and wailing, saying, "Alas, alas, that great city wherein were made rich all that had ships in the sea by reason of her costliness, for in 1 hour is she made desolate. Rejoice over her, you heaven, and you holy apostles and prophets, for God has avenged you on her." Think with what you might know about history. What city, if you turn it around the way the Catholics are going to explain it, is it which has persecuted the Roman Catholic Church and is going to receive its just deserts? Do you know what city that would be that the Roman Catholics are supposed to be rejoicing over as they see this prophecy? Some city that is that's called Babylon the Great? Can't be old Babylon. I doubt very much that it is, say, Islamabad. I doubt that it's New Delhi. No, I'm just quizzing you, but get you to thinking about it. It's obvious that it's not the Catholic Church that's being persecuted here, but it is that church that is the persecutor, the one who is responsible for all of this. "A mighty angel took up a stone like a great millstone and cast it into the sea, saying, 'Thus with violence shall that great city Babylon be thrown down and shall be found no more at all.'" Makes you almost wonder if God is going to smash it with a gigantic meteor from heaven or whether it's going to be nuclear weapons from some other source, from the beast power itself. And then it describes all of the lamenting, and the light of a candle shall shine no more, verse 23. And verse 24, for in her was found the blood of prophets and of saints and of all that were slain upon the earth. Then he sees a picture of a great voice of much people in heaven saying, hallelujah, salvation, glory, honor, and power unto the Lord our God. For true and righteous are his judgments, for he has judged the great whore, which did corrupt the earth with her fornication, and has avenged the blood of his servants at her hand. Right now, while we are sitting here, great history-breaking, precedent-setting events are taking place. Never in your lifetime has a pope gone to Jerusalem. Never in your lifetime did a pope kiss a vessel containing the soil of Jordan. Never in your lifetime has a pope gotten down in the grottos. Isn't it interesting? Everything happened in a grotto. A dank, dirty hole in the ground where they go down to where they claim the archangel announced to Mary that she was going to be with child. A dank, dirty hole in the ground where Jesus was born. A dank, dirty hole in the ground over which they built a church called the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. Not at Golgotha, where all of the biblical parameters absolutely fit, where the place of the skull is visible there today, where from the top of that it's only a short journey around to the base of it and in the tomb of the brand new tomb that is there, in the garden tomb that I've been inside of and done programs time and time again to prove that that is it. No, in a completely different part of Jerusalem is a church called the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. That's where the Pope went. He didn't go to Golgotha. He didn't go inside the tomb that belonged to Joseph of Arimathea. He went down into a grotto. So it's holes in the ground and grottos and candles and big old cathedrals and all sorts of funny signs in Latin. But now the man is reaching out to every religion in the world and to every government in the world. He's reaching out to the Chinese and the Koreans. He's reaching out to Islam and all of the Middle Eastern nations. He's reaching out to Jordan and the Arabs. He's reaching out to the Jews. He's reaching out to the Episcopalians and the Lutherans, reaching out to the Methodists and all of the churches. And he's the most revered, most popular, most awesome, most wondered at human being on the earth today. Meanwhile, behind the scenes in the Vatican, there is a real raging political firestorm as to who gets to be next. I've written about that in the current newspaper that is out and given you the names of the top contenders. And I will say this, that if and when we see the next pope taking the title of Sixtus the Sixth, it's going to raise the hackles on my neck, and I'm going to realize maybe that is just directly in your face, deliberate, because there are lots of Protestant bodies that have speculated about that, and that doesn't add up to 666. It only sounds like it. But it'll be interesting, and I'll guarantee you there are going to be millions of people playing with a man's name. They're going to be assigning numerical value to his name in the English language and any other language, and especially in Latin or the Roman numerals, Roman figures, to try to find out what it adds up to. If it does, without a lot of artificial manipulation, add up to 666, then look out, because he is the last one. We will know before too much longer.